talking to myself. So that makes it really hard to make it interesting or funny in any sort of way, because if I crack a joke, I feel like a complete idiot. Talking to myself, sometimes it goes the other way. If I have way too much coffee and I start talking to myself, it's a little bit like normal, so you might, you know, who knows. But
if it seems dry, you can always press pause,
go run a lap somewhere, and then come back with your file. Or if it's really slow, you can fast forward.
But I will assume that that you've at least listened to it insofar as you listen to the lectures and find them useful.
Okay. Any questions about that? Yes.
Will the homework for this week involve material that's on the lecture for Thursday that will be recorded?
I think the homework this week does not involve Gauss's law stuff, which is where we're really going to be. So I think not. Some of the stuff we're going to do today you may find useful for homework and workshop. I know some of you had workshops yesterday, so the synchronization isn't perfect with Monday workshops. Unfortunately, I'm not
sure how to work around that.
I will do my best to try to get that lecture up before normal lecture time on Thursday. If I don't succeed in that, I will try to do it as soon as possible after, but I think I probably have time tomorrow to do it. It's hard for me to actually do it until I get the lecture today, so I know where to start. So.
Okay, I got a question or two about this example problem we did in class, where we have this charge, positive lambda line segment of charge, and we evaluate the E at point Z up above the midpoint. So this is a standard geometry that you want to be good at for electric field calculations. And the confusion really boils down to, if you recall, we got to the end of this problem and it was quite a rush, and I just sort of scribbled down the solution and we had to come back to it the next time. When I came back to it the next time, the answer I wrote down was correct, but I skipped a step, and I think a couple of people, some of you found it a little too confusing. Not a good day for bad. Let's try this. Okay, we're going to go red today. All right, so if you recall, you know, the electric field goes as K dQ R over R squared, and only the Z component of E is active because the piece going to the left and the right for little dQs here and here will cancel out by symmetry. So you change dQ to lambda dx, and then it's the cosine theta component that adds, so you have a 2 times cosine theta z hat gives you the direction of z, and it's all over r squared. So I want to actually integrate in x dx. I've defined that across here, and I'll go from 0 to L, so that's where the 2 comes in. So 0 to L, and then I rewrite r squared and cosine theta in terms of the z, and if I put an x here, then this would be my r, and this would be my z, and this is what I have as cosine theta. So when I rewrite all those pieces, which I think we did fairly carefully in class, so I'm not worrying too much about that now, you get this, okay? And I believe in my notes in class earlier, I may have forgotten the dx here, and then we got in a hurry. So I can pull out the 2k lambda z. Z is a constant, and the integral that you have to do is dx over x squared plus z squared to the 3/2. So even if I'm careful, all right, and wow, I was being careful. Who would have figured? I think this is to the 1/2. So so this becomes your integral, and when you do that integral, you get this. and you evaluate it between 0 and L. So the X is the thing that you're integrating over, so that's where you put in the L here and here. And then, at least this day, when we were evaluating units and limiting cases, this is the answer that we got, and we evaluated all those things correctly. So that's the correct answer. All right, but if you found some of these sets a little confusing, I hope you can fill in the holes here. Okay? Any other questions on this one? All right. So last time we started talking about electric flux, and we defined flux to be how much electric field effectively penetrates through a surface. And so if it's an open surface, you get to define what direction you call positive in a sense. If it's a closed surface, the outside would be the direction that, by convention, we consider positive flux. If flux flows from inside to outside, it would be considered positive. So the flux is an integral over whatever the surface is of E dot dA, because you really want to know how much electric field penetrates the surface. So any component of the electric field that is parallel to the surface, then it doesn't penetrate through the surface, so it doesn't count. So you use this dot product to project out the component of the electric field that is perpendicular to the surface, and you do that by asking for that component of the electric field that is parallel to the n-hat or the dA vector, which you use to define the orientation of the surface. Okay, so at any point on the surface, you can imagine there being a little element of surface dA, which is defined by a vector that points out perpendicular to it, and that vector then might have magnitude dA and give you an orientation for the surface. Or you could say that you have a surface area of dA, and you have a vector n hat, which is perpendicular to it, and the dA element then is fully defined by saying that it is dA magnitude times n hat vector to get the direction. So both ways are valid. And however you write it, you take the dot product of the electric field with that differential area vector and you integrate that over the surface. And so that sums how much electric field penetrates through the surface. If you have a surface like this and you have a little n hat pointing out that's in a positive direction, and you have electric field lines penetrating into the surface, E dot n hat will be negative. So long as you have the definition of this n hat pointing out, then summing this will take care of whether it's going in or out, because the dot product gives you that sum. Any questions about flux? Okay, so this is always true. It is not always easy to calculate straight up, okay? But conceptually, it is always true. So just keep that in mind. And then, of course, knowing what it is, sometimes it's easy to calculate. So we found that calculating the electric field sometimes is a bear. I imagine you're facing some of that in the problem set this week. So you all learned to appreciate Gauss's law this week. Gauss's law says that if you have a closed surface, the flux through that surface is equal to the amount of charge, the net charge that is enclosed within that surface, regardless of its shape, divided by the constant epsilon naught. So there's Gauss's law. So why do we care? What are these things? This is the integral over the Gaussian surface. I said if I have some surface that encloses charge. Okay, so I'll give you a physical problem, and it may actually have a physical surface on which we deposit charge. Or it could have, you know, a shell on which we're depositing charge. All right? You might divorce. This is true whether that surface has a physical reality or if it's just in your imagination. Okay? So, it could be that you're evaluating something and you have a physical surface there and you use this along the way. And that's maybe easy to see. But I can imagine having a fictitious surface in space. There might be a real surface inside, there might be one outside, it doesn't matter. And that fictitious surface I can define as a Gaussian surface. I just imagine that it's there. And if I have that there, mathematically, I can still say this is true. It's just I evaluate the flux over that surface. So when we talk about evaluating the flux, we talk about a Gaussian surface, which may or may not correspond in reality to a particular surface in the problem. In fact, almost all the time, the usefulness of Gauss's law will come in. You will be imagining a surface with a particular symmetry and in a particular space, and it is there that you'll be evaluating Gauss's law. So this is the integral over the Gaussian surface. This is E dot dA. Just to... Gauss's law is particularly useful when you have conditions of symmetry such that it is easy to evaluate. If I have an arbitrary surface, that is not true. So, as a general rule, this looks completely useless. But in practice, there are some circumstances where it is incredibly useful. So, for example, E dot dA. This dot product is very easy if E is perpendicular to the surface, so it is parallel to dA, or if it is parallel to the surface, so it's perpendicular to dA. So that dot product at that point is either E times dA or it's zero. And you can just look at it and you know that if you have the symmetry in the case right. If, in fact, you have the symmetry in the problem such that you know that the electric field on the Gaussian surface that you choose has to be a constant. So imagine I have a problem that has complete spherical symmetry. I may have charge in there, but it is spherically symmetric. If I choose a Gaussian surface that has spherical symmetry with the same center, then the electric field has to be radial. And it has to have the same magnitude everywhere on that surface. So if, for example, in that circumstance, then the dot product becomes E times dA because E has to be radial, dA is radial, and the electric field is constant on that surface. So when I evaluate this, it becomes just an integral over dA, and the magnitude of E is constant. It just pulls right out. So this left-hand side under those circumstances becomes very easy to evaluate. And I want you to do it very carefully a couple of times as we go through things, but then you're going to get to where you can basically just write that side down often if the problem has certain symmetry. The right-hand side, again, could be arbitrarily difficult to know how much charge is in there. If it has some weird distribution, you may not be able to calculate that easily. What is the enclosed charge? It is the integral over the inside of your Gaussian surface, which may or may not correspond to a physical surface that's in the problem. But you hypothesize whatever Gaussian surface it is, you ask what is the charge enclosed within it, because that's what corresponds to this surface integral over here. That integral will be the integral of the volume charge density over the volume, which, again, could be arbitrarily difficult, but sometimes it's very easy. And if you choose to do Gauss's law on problems with certain symmetry, then you'll find that these integrals can be quite easy to do. The minute you have that, then you'll have some expression for E evaluated at some position, which is where your Gaussian surface is, and you've evaluated this side and basically you can find the expression for E. So it becomes, for certain types of symmetries, a fabulous way to calculate the electric field. Why do you want the electric field? Because the electric field gives you the force, and the force basically tells you what's going to go on in the problem. Okay, so any questions conceptually? Okay, so the kinds of symmetries that are particularly good to do with Gauss's law typically are things with spherical symmetry for the reasons I just showed you. Cylindrical symmetry, and it may not be quite as obvious, but for cylindrical symmetry, if I choose a cylindrical Gaussian surface, then by the symmetry of this problem, having cylindrical symmetry, I know that the electric field will have to be radially outward from the line. So if that's true, then on this curved surface, this n hat has to be out, and the electric field is that way. So n hat dot E is going to be simple, just E times dA. And on these surfaces, the end caps, remember, it has to be a closed surface, so you can't just say it's a pipe. You have to include the end caps. But on the end caps, n hat is perpendicular to the electric field, which is pointing out radial. So that's going to be zero. So this geometry works really well. Planar geometry is often very interesting. So if I have a planar geometry and I think of a Gaussian surface like a pillbox or something, again, by symmetry, the electric field is going to be moving away from the plane, and so it's going to be parallel to the end caps and perpendicular to the pipes. So it's a little bit the reverse of this in some sense, but again, the symmetry is very useful. So you might say, I feel very constrained, Professor. Now you're only allowing me to do things with spherical or linear, cylindrical or planar geometries. I'm more of a hyperspace sort of girl or whatever. You know, whatever. It turns out the world can be thought of as lots of spheres and lines and planes where electricity is concerned, right? Any sort of line becomes something with spherical geometry. You might say, but this line curves like that. Okay, true. But if you go down to a small enough region of it, it looks like an infinite line. So you can consider, you can solve for the electric field close enough to any sort of simple line using cylindrical geometry in a sense. That may not be practically useful enough for you if you're actually going to build a real circuit. Okay, that you have to worry about. But in terms of trying to get at the essence of things, you can do this. Spheres are also useful. Planes, you know. So you'll find this is incredibly useful. Okay? So those are the geometries you want to think about. If the problem comes with a clean geometry like this, I won't say it will always be something you want to do Gauss's law for, but very often it is. So you definitely want to be considering Gauss's law if you see one of these geometries. Okay? All right. So Gauss's law is not always used in some symmetrical situation. Sometimes the basic idea of Gauss's law turns out to be pretty useful. So if we suppose that I have some chunk of metal or something. So we'll say this is a conductor. And let's say that we have an electric field in space around here in this region of the world. Okay? What happens inside the conductor? What is a conductor? If I say this is a conductor, what do I really mean?
The electrons can move freely.
Okay, so in this class, charge moves freely. And in fact, just sort of have to keep that in mind because, yeah, you're right, electrons move freely. But
by convention, we will call positive charge often. That's what we'll think of as moving. So it will be confusing more occasions than I can, probably for you in this class. At any rate, that's the thing. Charges can move in a conductor freely, by definition. If you're a purist, you say, wait a minute, or how do I say, if you're a little bit anal, not quite, because even conductors have a little bit of resistance. Yeah, okay, granted, we're not talking superconductors. But for this class, if I say conductor, charges move freely. Okay, so what would be the electric field inside the conductor?
Zero.
How do you know that?
Because if there were still a field inside of the conductor, electrons would still be moving.
Right. So in principle, you could have that, I guess. You'd have a wire, put electric field across it, and you get a current. You get charges continuously moving. But we're in electrostatics right now, in this part of the class. So if I just have a static electric field, I don't have this connected to anything, then in fact, that's exactly right. I might have an electric field in the conductor, but if I do, the charges will move freely until they cancel it out. So if I have an electric field here, then the positive charges will flow down, and the negative charges will flow upward. And if you think about the electric field of just those charges, you'll have electric field lines that effectively go like that between those charges, and they will cancel out the external electric field that penetrates into the conductor. And one way to think about it is you think, well, the field doesn't actually penetrate into the conductor. But another way to think about it is it does, but the charge within the conductor rearranges until you have exact time of cancellation. Okay? And if you don't have exact time of cancellation, you have electric field and conductor charges can move, and they will continue to move until you cancel. Okay? All right. So, where does the charge reside? Suppose I have some arbitrary conductor. I will imagine having a Gaussian surface just inside the surface of our physical conductor. Can have an arbitrary shape. If I invoke Gauss's law over such a thing, the integral of E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. But we have just sort of motivated the fact that if I go inside the conductor at all, the electric field has to be zero. Otherwise, charges flow until it becomes zero. So therefore, the left-hand side is zero, because E is equal to zero. So that means the charge that is enclosed inside that Gaussian surface is also zero. So if I were to take any conductor out there and deposit charge on it, it will have to reside on the outside of the conductor. Okay? And that just comes straight from Gauss's law. Now, I know for some of you this may be hard to believe. For most of us grow up thinking, surely there are charges that can exist inside conductors freely. Behold, we have our electroscope, and if I charge up this rod and I come close to this thing, you can see that the electric field on the rod basically repels charge down onto the, or from here it goes up, onto this metal thing. I get the same sign charge here and here, and the gold leaf will move. Okay?
A conducting screen. Which I'm placing over said electroscope. Ready? There's no evidence of that electric field penetrating. Indeed, it is charged. Is that cool or what? Electrostatic shielding, you call it. You can make electric fields go away if you shield against them with a conductor. So if you're building some device someday that has extreme hypersensitivity to extraneous electric fields from automobiles being turned on, dryers going off or whatever. We call this noise if you're building an experiment, right? You're looking, things look well behaved, and all of a sudden it just goes to hell and you have no idea why. And we'll look at this, but basically if I take charge or magnets or whatever and I move them around, they will send out extraneous electric fields that will pass through your device and can cause all sorts of problems in your electric circuit. So it's very much a real story. I had a friend who ran a very sensitive set of equipment actually in a lab at Yale at one point, and they noticed that every day at a particular time the results just went to hell, and they eventually traced it down to the UPS deliveries. The UPS guy would come and his car would idle on the other side of the wall. And they had problems. So one way to solve these things, there are many ways to try to beat noise down, but one way is to take your device and put it in an electrostatic shield or a big conductor. And I've even seen rooms that were literally just metal rooms for this reason. So it's pretty neat stuff. It's too bad we can't do that with gravity. Maybe one of you guys will figure it out. Okay. So we're going to have to do three-dimensional problems, and they're not always going to have nice, simple Cartesian geometries. So we're going to have to start thinking a little bit about curvilinear coordinates. It may seem a little bit odd because we're very married to sort of this Cartesian world, but you can actually have sort of generalized curvilinear coordinate system. And have all sorts of strange things. So you could have an intersection here, 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 and then one here, 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 or something like that. So you can have really strange coordinates in principle. And there are nice treatments of this that you can use to sort of translate whatever math you're doing into whatever coordinate system you want. But I'm not going to take you through the general case. Just know that it exists. But there are the geometries that we've seen, cylindrical and circular and spherical, that we want to get really good at. And some of this will be old hat to some of you. Maybe you haven't really thought about this context, but let's make sure that we're all on the same page where this stuff is concerned, because it's pretty important. So let's recall, if I have a circle, if it doesn't look very circular, I will try to fix that. Oops. Hello. Okay, so I have something of a circle, and if it has a given radius, and I subtend an angle theta, then this is it's S. So I know that S is equal to R theta, so we're going to be using that a whole lot. And let's suppose now I have a circle, and I actually just want to calculate the area of the circle. So let's say that I have a circle that lies in some very ugly way, in the XY plane, and I want to calculate its area, and we'll say it's centered at the origin, then I can imagine having two radial lines coming out through that circle, and we'll say that it has a radius, I'll call it big R. And what I'd like to do is let's find the area of the circular disk. So a way to do that is to find a differential piece of area and then just sum it over everything. Okay? And so the typical differential piece of area you might consider would be one that basically has a smaller radius. So I have a distance here, which is dr, and I have a distance here, which is ds. So if I consider that, I can say that I have a differential area A, which is equal to dr times ds. Now you might be bothered by the fact that this ds and that ds are slightly different radii. So in fact, they have to be slightly different in length. However, since they're separated by a differential dr, which is so tiny, you can ignore them. Right? So we don't worry about that. So what I'm writing here basically assumes that I have a square. So I have it by dr by ds in size. So to calculate the area, then what I'd like to do is to integrate over this entire disk all those little differential area elements. And I can do that by integrating around an angle here. I'll call it theta. And I can integrate out in R. And that covers the full area. So this integral becomes the integral from 0 out to big R of the angular piece, which goes from 0 to 2 pi, so I'm going to do this is going to be theta, and then I'm going to integrate out in R. Okay, and that'll give me the full set of things. So dA is equal to dr ds. The problem is I'm not integrating in ds. I'm integrating in theta and dr. So I have to rewrite this dA in terms of theta and dr. So dA ds here becomes r d theta. Right, at a fixed r, I go across ds, I'm going out at d theta. So if I open up theta a little bit, I'm opening up s a little bit. The r is fixed. So dA becomes r d theta d r d theta dr. So r d theta dr. So if I integrate from 0 to 2 pi d theta, I just get 2 pi. So this is equal to 2 pi times the integral from 0 to r of r dr, which is r squared over 2, which gives me pi r squared, which you should all know. All right? So I'm fine. You should, of course, just know pi r squared, but I wanted to take you through the steps because it's a little more complicated than the Cartesian stuff because we sort of get this strange extraneous scale factor, we call it. Because what you mean when you say ds depends on r. So the size of this little square you've got depends on where you are in r if you're integrating over the angle. So you have to put in the scale factor. You okay with that? Okay. This turns out to be really important if we're doing something with cylindrical geometry. So think Gauss's law. Cylindrical coordinates are made up of a circle that then slides in space along the symmetry axis. Okay? And in cylindrical coordinates, you have the radius r, which is the radius of the pipe. And in fact, you consider the angle, often actually call it phi for maximal confusion. We call it theta for a circle. Here you'll call it phi, but phi goes from 0 to 2 pi in the cylindrical geometry. So the circular geometry is, you know, it's very important for cylindrical things. Because it's nothing but a circle or a disk that then slides along the axis. So you can think about it that way. The trickier part comes with spherical geometry. And I didn't want to draw all this so much, so I'm sorry, it'll be in the notes. There's a very good discussion of this in the classic E&M book by David Griffiths. So that is a text that's about right for 217, but it does have a nice discussion of these scale factors. We're going to go through this, and then I'm going to show you some simplifying assumptions that we're going to use for all the problems we're going to do. So you're not always going to have to go through full three-dimensional integrals for all this. All right, so in spherical polar coordinates, you have a problem, say, with spherical symmetry. A point on the surface of a sphere then can be located by, it's at a certain radius. It is defined to be down by a certain angle, theta, from the positive z-axis. And in this dimension, it's defined by angle phi from the positive x-axis. All right, so those are your three coordinates. And if I now want to ask what is the volume of a sphere, then what I would like to do, because of the symmetry of the problem, I want to integrate in r, theta, and phi, not in x, y, and z. So that means I want to have a volume element that is in r, theta, and phi, not in x, y, and z. So here is a differential volume element drawn up in r, theta, and phi. So it's going to be dr thick this way, okay?
And then the question is, what are these other pieces? So, what we just found, imagine I have a circle that goes around. It's a little hard to draw. Imagine I have a circle that goes down from the z-axis through our point, around and back up, but it's in the plane that is defined by this. Does that make sense? No? Okay.
Think how best to do this.
This line right here defines a quarter of a circle. So if I think of this line, that line, and this line, that's a plane. And you can consider that I have that circle going back around, hitting the minus z-axis, and back up to here. Better? If I have a circle, and I ask, what is my differential element in this direction, in theta? Just like we did with a circle a moment ago, the arc length here, the differential arc length, is going to be equivalent to r d theta. So this piece is really a ds, a long theta, and it is r d theta. Okay? This piece, you see the piece, I mean, that is a ds, but it is now a ds for phi, because we're now talking about the circle that goes this way, and that's phi. Alright? So, if this point is actually here, then it's just a circle, and it becomes r d phi, just like we've had r d theta for the circle earlier. Okay? But it's not that simple, because you note that as I go up in the sphere, this piece projects down and it has a smaller radius than out here. So if the sphere goes up and I consider a part up here, if I'm taking the plane that bisects the sphere and I'm rotating it around this way, if I'm out low on the sphere, that rotation of the point on the edge of the sphere goes all the way around. But if I'm up here, that rotation is only a smaller circle. Okay? So we have a point here that if you just consider the rotation this way, that rotates through a smaller circle, and at the same time this one rotates through a bigger circle. So the RD phi that I get to define that S, the R isn't the same R as the full radius of the sphere. It is the R that corresponds to the projection down along onto this plane. And that projection is the same as this projection, which is equal to R times the sine of theta. So you get an extra r in there and a sine theta. So that means if this is ds, then the element ds corresponds to r d phi, but it's not that simple because it has to project out. So it's r sine theta d phi. So this ds corresponds to r sine theta d phi. So now I have the three different pieces, and I have to multiply them together to get the full differential volume. So I have the piece out here, which is dr. So in the r direction, I have just a thickness dr. In the theta direction, I have d theta, but that, I'm sorry, I have ds, but that corresponds to r d theta. So I have dr times r d theta. And then in the phi direction, I have a ds, but that now corresponds to r sine theta d phi. So if I multiply all those things together, I end up with the differential volume equal to r squared sine theta d phi dr. Fun stuff.
I know I'm pointing to a lot of lines up here, and this may be a little hard. Maybe I should take the time and just draw it out. But I think actually this is the kind of thing that I really can't open your heads up and make it make sense. You really just have to go and stare at this geometry until it begins to make sense for you. Probably is worth your while to do it, because then you'll understand where this complicated, strange element comes from, these scale factors for spherical polar coordinates. Alright, so if it's Cartesian, it'd be simple, dx, dy, dz. But if I go to spherical coordinates, in r I have dr, in theta I have r d theta, and in phi I have r sine theta d phi. Stare at that until you think it makes sense, but I'm going to move on right now unless you have a specific question. Okay, so if we ask, what is the area of a sphere? Here's our sphere. We can consider some sort of little differential area, dA, that is on the surface of the sphere. That area is equal to the integral over all dAs that you would have. In this case, I don't worry about the dr, because I'm not integrating out in r. I would do that if I wanted to know the volume. Okay, but if I just want the area of a sphere, then I know I have to integrate in theta from 0 to pi, because theta goes from plus z down to minus z, and then 2 pi in phi. All right. So this dA, in this case, dA is equal to the ds in the theta direction and the ds in the phi direction. And it does depend on the radius. So this will be r d theta times r sine theta d phi. So it's going to be r squared sine theta d phi. But there's no dr. For dr, it's simple. It doesn't come in with a separate scale factor. So all right, so to evaluate the integral, this is equal to the integral from 0 to pi, and this will be the 1 over theta, all right? And I'll do an integral from 0 to 2 pi over phi. Of r squared, sine theta, d phi. Oh, so the r just pulls out, and the integral from 0 to 2 pi of just d phi, because these have been phi dependents, the integral from 0 to 2 pi of just d phi just gives you 2 pi. So this becomes 2 pi r squared times the integral from 0 to pi of sine theta d theta. And that integral is equal to 2. And so this whole thing turns out to be equal to 4 pi r squared, which I hope isn't news to you.
If it is, then let it not be from now forth, because you want to use it all the time. The area, the surface area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. Okay? The volume is 4/3 pi r cubed.
you'll get real good at it, because you're going to do a lot of problems with them. But
all right, so that's how you do these things, and I don't remember at what stage you start doing these nested multidimensional integrals. Many of you have probably seen it. Some of you, probably all of you have, but you may not have used it a whole lot. So that said, there will come a day, if you continue down the path that you are on, where you will have very complicated problems that have significant angular dependence, which means these integrals become significantly too arbitrarily difficult. Yeah.
Well, are there different conventions between math and physics for spherical coordinates?
Job security. Got to make it as hard as possible. Part of it is, it's just a convention. It's just a variable. Within the context of that problem, it's well-defined, and you use it accordingly. And you shouldn't be too hung up on any convention or any variable. I think that's a little bit crap, because, face it, right? You get used to doing it a certain way, and then it actually is confusing when you start seeing other conventions. And it can be misleading, because, you know, so it's not necessarily a good thing, but how that one historically arose, I don't know. I have to confess, though, I think I was a math major, and I don't remember seeing it differently here.
It's like, it's explained differently in, like, the old, like, which one is which.
Oh, all right, yeah. I'll have to go. I'll go look up one of my math books and see if I... Maybe it's a new way of doing it since I had my stuff a long time ago, but I don't know. Okay. All right, so in principle, for all of these problems that involve cylindrical symmetry, spherical symmetry, we have to do, and rectangular, we have to do these three-dimensional integrals. And life can be hard. If I want to make it really miserable, I put in some serious angular dependence in the problem, and life becomes really hard. I'm not going to do that to you intentionally. Okay. So what I'm going to do, what I will promise you, is that I will give you problems that have the angular dependence, no angular dependence in cylindrical problems, and no angular dependence in the spherical problem. Okay? I may get nasty to you for the radial dependence if I wanted to, but I'm not going to give you angular dependence. So what that means is that you really don't have to do the multiple integral thing all the time. What we're going to do is you have to imagine, we have to be a little liberated about what our differential areas or differential volumes look like. And when we do that, you'll find that you can actually make these things one-dimensional problems. So let's imagine that we have a circle. Let's pretend we don't remember the area of a circle. And if you recall earlier, I wanted to know the area of a circle. I chose, some element that looks like this, and dA then is equal to this dr r d theta, and the area is equal to the integral from 0 to r times the integral from 0 to 2 pi of r d theta dr, right? So that's what we did, and it worked. But you could imagine actually doing this a different way. You could say, well, there's my circle. I know I have no angular dependence. So what I'm going to do is assume that my differential area is actually a ring of width dr,
And the circumference is the circumference of the circle. So I'll say that my differential area is 2 pi r for that radius times dr. Which is exactly what you get after you do the angular integral here. You get 2 pi r dr. But do you see it's sort of a different way of looking at it? And if I don't have angular dependence, I think of this differential area being a circle of width dr, and that's now an area of 2 pi r dr. I still have the differential aspect of it, which is in dr, which I do have to integrate over, but I now have a one-dimensional integral. So if I think of it this way, then I basically say that the area is equal to just the integral from 0 out to r of 2 pi r dr. And you're done. So it becomes a one-dimensional thing. So let's imagine that we have a sphere. And let's ask, what is the volume of a sphere? And you saw earlier, in order to get the volume of the sphere, we need to sum up all of the little differential volumes, which turns out to be this nasty triple integral over r squared sine theta d theta d phi dr, right? So that's a bit nasty. Well, another way to think about it would be to consider a spherical shell centered with the same symmetry. I know the area of that. That's 4 pi r squared. And I make it a volume element by saying it's 4 pi r squared times dr. So I make a spherical shell of thickness dr. And the volume of that is 4 pi r squared times the dr. So now my differential volume is equal to 4 pi r squared dr. So to do the volume of a sphere, it's equal to the integral over all the dv's, which is going to be the integral from 0 out to big R of 4 pi r squared dr, which is going to be 4 thirds pi r cubed, which we know to be the volume of a sphere. Okay? So even though you're going to do complicated spherical problems and cylindrical problems, if you learn to choose the differential elements right, you're only going to do one-dimensional integral all the time. Right? And I will give you charge distributions that have cylindrical or spherical symmetry. So you may have to worry about R dependence, but you're not going to have to worry about anything. Any questions? All right, so let's play with an example. Let's say that I have something that has spherical symmetry. Let's say that I have a radius of this sphere, big R. And we'll say that rho, it's a volume charge density in this sphere, is equal to some constant times r cubed for r less than big R. So that's, now I now have a charge distribution that is growing as the cube of r as I go out until I get to big R. And it's equal to 0 for r greater than big R. And then the question is,
you know, what is Q total inside the sphere and Q total, well, I don't have to worry about outside, but if I ask let me rephrase that. Let us say that we're doing Gauss's law. What is Q-tote for a Gaussian surface? With R less than big R. So Q tote for R less than big R. So I now have some Gaussian surface in here which has a little r. That's going to be the integral of rho times dv over the whole volume, okay? You look at it, you say, okay, it has spherical symmetry. So my dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr. And I only need to integrate over r. If I'm asking how much charge is inside the Gaussian surface, I integrate from 0 up to only little r of rho, which is kr cubed, times dv. And dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr. So this is equal to the integral from 0 to little r, k pulls out, 4 pi pulls out, if I want to. Of r to the fifth, so it's k 4 pi r to the 6 over 6. K has to have the units to make this thing work out. In fact, you can note that k, since it has to give you rho, which is coulombs per meter cubed, k has to have units of coulombs per meter to the 6. Right? A little bit weird, but okay. If I ask, what is the charge for some Gaussian surface outside big R? So if I'm evaluating the field, say, for example, on a Gaussian surface outside of big R, then Q tote inside for R greater than big R, it's the same integral, but now you don't integrate all the way out to little r because the charge only exists out to big R. Your Gaussian surface is now outside of that. So you have to remember that in this case, you're only integrating from 0 to big R of the same thing, k 4 pi r to the 5th. And you get the 4 pi r squared, I mean the 4 pi r squared dr is the same thing. So this then becomes, there's a limit to it. You have k 4 pi big R to the 6 over 6. So for these problems, the kinds of mistakes that are very, 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 very easy to make are inadvertently choosing the wrong radius for your integral. So if you are evaluating the charge because you want to get the field inside of big R, then you want to choose a Gaussian surface at some arbitrary little r inside big R. And when you write up Gauss's law, you want to evaluate the total charge within just that Gaussian surface.
So that means you do the integral for Q tot only out to that little r, not out to the big R. Alright? If you have a surface way out here, you don't integrate all the way out to big R if the charge all stops. You don't integrate all the way out to little r because you don't want that full volume because you only have charge over that smaller volume. So you really have to watch your limits of integration and think about what it is you're actually integrating. Is this the, when you do, having said that, right, if you have this Gaussian surface way out here at some arbitrary r bigger than the big R, if when you're evaluating the E dot dA piece, you are looking at the electric field on that surface. So the R you use is the little r, not the big R. So you have to pay attention to what it is you're actually calculating and make sure that you're looking at the correct radius. By far and away, most mistakes on Gauss's law problems come from sort of taking that step a little too quickly and integrating out to the wrong radius and just picking the wrong one. Okay? You have a cell phone, my watch and my computer are disagreeing on the time. What time is it?
17.
All right. All right, so let's imagine that we have an infinite line charge. And you may recall in an earlier class, I used a limiting case of some L for this midpoint, this charge segment. I let L go to infinity, and I said, we'll know what that field is at some point. Now is sort of the point. I'll do this a little quickly. I'll try to come back to it for Thursday. This problem has cylindrical symmetry. So what I'd like to know is, what is the field at some radius r outside of the line? Because it has cylindrical symmetry, any charge I have over here and any charge I have over here will cancel out these components. So I know the field has to have radial symmetry. So if the field has radial symmetry and cylindrical problem, I will hypothesize that I have a Gaussian surface that looks like a cylinder centered on the same line of symmetry. All right? And then I'll calculate the integral of E dot dA. I'll say that I have a constant line charge lambda, and that's equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. What you need to keep in mind is that if I say over the area of this cylinder, it has n caps and a pi. The n caps do not always go to zero, so don't get in the habit of ignoring them. But because I'm in a hurry, I'm just going to verbally sort of show you what's going on. So on the n caps, n hat goes out. So when I do E dot dA, it's always zero. So the n caps go to zero in their contribution to this integral. E dot dA is E times dA in terms of going out the pipe. The field is going to be the same everywhere on the pipe. So this piece becomes E, which pulls out of the integral, of the surface area of the pipe, which is 2 pi r times z in length. If I assume some arbitrary length z. How much charge is enclosed? In this Gaussian surface, it's going to be this z times lambda over epsilon naught as the other side. That means that E is radially outward, and it's equal to lambda over R epsilon naught. There's a 2 pi. The Z's cancel. And if I did that right, that should agree with the limiting case we got the other day. Okay? So I'll write that up a little more carefully for Thursday. Anyway. Okay? So have a good weekend. I'll be out of town, but you still owe me homework. So
Oh, the other thing I forgot to say is if you have questions, feel free to email me. I will be in email touch, so I will try to respond.